search for God outside of ourselves. Otto Rank speaks of the original wound instead of Augustine's original sin. The original wound is the human tendency to separate and divide. It's easy for us to fall into this approach. We are trained at an early age to use our external senses to differentiate. We, in fact, need our external senses to grow and develop. And when we are deprived or lose the use of one or more of our external senses, we are required to make adjustments and compensations. We are not as well trained, however, to listen to our interior senses, that is to say, our soul, which tends to unite rather than divide. Children require others for their survival. They might complain, when all is well, about their dependency, but they also instinctively know that they are dependent upon others if they are to survive. Parents in particular, and other adults in general, are necessary and, because they are essential, provide us with our initial sense of who God is for us. That is, we sense in these external creatures upon who we depend for survival, God. It is one of the reasons that children who are abused are so mistrustful of others and life in general, and so dependent upon others and life, even as they enclose themselves with ever more protective layers. Their survival instinct tells them that they are necessarily dependent upon a monster. Their initial image of God as a result is badly misshapen by their experience. This initial image of God, as good as it can be, also has shortcomings. It is almost entirely external. We experience a connection with our parents, but they do not abide within us. They are separate, external, and their love is flawed. Any sense of authority and authenticity that we might have comes essentially from this external source. We are who our parents tell us we are. Not entirely, but certainly we are highly influenced by them. When we simply accept our initial exterior experience of God, which is often primarily based upon our experience of parents and significant adults, we lack an interior ground in authenticity. An indication that we are seeking God almost exclusively externally is that culture, people, ideas, success, ambition, status, and reputation unduly influence us. We move from one retreat, one charismatic or dynamic leader, one author, one weekend experience, one organization, one popular fad, to another, always seeking more. Living almost exclusively externally quickly and easily draws us into addiction. That is, anything of which we need more and more, because it can only momentarily satisfy us. An example of this way of living can be found in the Gospels, in the story about the two sons and the loving father, Luke 15, I believe that was last weekend's Gospel. The reaction of the older son is very telling. He repeatedly practices what society and culture tells him that a good son must do. He relates externally with his father as his only authority. All is well until his father, so the son thinks, changes. His father stops meeting his expectation. Exclusively external images can't change. We don't allow them to change. They are fixed. We sometimes call them perfect. Then the internal anger and resentments that have been fermenting, unchecked and without the older son's conscious knowledge, erupt. He feels that his father has betrayed him and has undercut who he understands himself to be. His external authority no longer meets his expectation, which causes a crisis within himself. His world and expectations are turned upside down and thwarted. He is outraged by what his father has done. He can't accept what his father has done because the actions of his father toward the younger son undermine the external laws by which he governs his life. You never even gave me a kid or a goat so that I could have my friends over to eat. It's all external. Little wonder there is so much hatred, anger, and resentment. Look historically, and I'm not putting blame on anyone, but historically, for example, the Catholic Church in Canada, it all happened also in the United States, but in Canada, it was a common practice for many of the priests to go around to the houses yearly. And if the wife was not pregnant, both she and her husband would be berated because it was her responsibility to get pregnant each year. And if she was not, that meant that they were probably using birth control, and that is a mortal sin. What happened by the 1950s, and in particular 1960s, is that there's a reaction to that. In Canada, which went from being an almost 80-90% Catholic nation, went down to about 20%. It was an external authority that met with reaction. Jesus warns us not to search for the kingdom here or there. God is found within us, abiding with us. The reflections of John of the Cross in the Spiritual Canticle seek to help us find God abiding with us. Now, this is my interpretation. If you disagree with it, that's fine. I'm not an external. Initially, as we begin this journey, we discover that our seeking takes place almost exclusively externally. The soul experiences God in creation. When I was young, for example, I would experience God, though I did not use that name, in the stillness that fell upon our neighborhood on a late Saturday afternoon. Though lasting only minutes, the unnamed experience felt reassuring. These experiences, however, last only until we get busy with other activities. Then they fade into the background. John writes, addressing Mother Anne of Jesus in the prologue to the Spiritual Canticle, "Who can describe the understanding God gives to loving souls in whom God dwells? And who can express the experience that God imparts to them?" He will go on to explain that mystical theology cannot be understood by scholastic theology because their experiences overflow in figures and similes and from the abundance of their spirit pour out secrets and mysteries rather than rational explanations. So mystical theology deals in symbols, deals in the area of the spirit, the soul, secrets and mysteries, darkness, rather than rational explanations that clarify, that divide, that distinct, that distinguish one factor from another. John doesn't dismiss scholastic theology, that's his education. He says that it provides words and thoughts that can be helpful. That's what theology is meant to do. And we're talking about God. Scholastic theology is categorizing different characteristics of how God can be recognized in doing for us. Mystical theology doesn't categorize anything. Mystical theology essentially makes links between seemingly unrelated realities. He likens scholastic theology to seeking God externally. The human mind, because of the original wound, looks to explanations rather than experience, which more readily enters mystery and darkness and expands into love and union. Mystical theology, which continues to be our experience of God doing for us rather than God. And that's important for us to know. Mystical theology is not capturing God in any way, but recognizing how God relates with us, God does for us, frees us to enter more fully the soul's interior converse with God, as John says. The poem begins with the soul searching for God in exterior experiences of God in creation. The soul at this point experiences somewhat God abiding, but continues to defer to the external experiences of God. You fled like the stag after wounding me. So there's a lasting experience, but it's not an experience of great rejoicing, but rather a feeling that we are wounded. The experience of union has begun with the soul's knowing that it is connected with creation, but separateness remains. Practicing experiencing God in creation and living in connection with creation frees us to experience the outer journey as also the inner journey. So no longer is there a distinction that begins to blur. But the journey, the exterior journey, becomes also the inner journey. Do not send me any more messengers. They cannot tell me what I must hear. Again, all who are free, tell me 1,000 graceful things of you. All wound me more, and leave me dying of our I don't know what behind their stammering. So there's a growing dissatisfaction with only the external experience of God. The experience of union draws near. How do you endure, O life, not living where you live and being brought near death by the arrows you receive from that which you conceive of your beloved? The soul is moving towards the mental understanding of God, often to the experience of God firsthand, or at least by the way in which God does for us. The mind, however, continues to interfere. Why, since you wounded this heart, don't you heal it? And why, since you stole it from me, do you leave it so and fail to carry off what you have stolen? We're not above complaining. Practicing the painful struggle to reconcile two seemingly opposite realities, our humanity and God's divinity, our struggle to remain separate in God's yearning for union, our need to remain stuck in our limited understanding and God's freedom to love, pushes us further and further on the interior journey. And so the wound, which we would prefer not to have, actually pushes us on the journey. It is a journey that begins, once we consciously experience it, with suffering. Why, since you wounded this heart, don't you heal it? And suffering gradually becomes our companion on the journey. That doesn't mean that we gleefully enjoy suffering. I think there's a name for that. No, often we complain. Extinguish these miseries. We even pray for death. And may the vision of your beauty be my death. For the sickness of love is not cured except by your very presence and image. It is no longer either or. Our minds and our souls blend. And the blending of the two increases our suffering because we are not in control. Life is happening to us. O spring like crystal, if only on your silvered over face you would suddenly form the eyes I have desired, which I bear sketched deep within my heart. Withdraw them, beloved. I am taking flight. The desire to see God as God sees us, the reflection in the mirror. The soul returns to the more familiar external experience of God. So there's the journey within often returns to the outer journey. My beloved is the mountains and lonely wooded valleys. And when she does, activities also return. Be still, deadening north wind, south wind, come, you that awaken love. You girls of Judah, while among flowers and roses the amber spreads its perfume, stay away, there on the outskirts. Do not so much as seek to touch our thresholds. We're back and forth. The inner journey returns to the outer journey. And activities return. They're not bad. They're there. We can't get rid of them. We can complain about them a little bit. It's a both-and situation, and it creates for us an environment in which we continue to know that we are wounded. And that we are not in control of this situation. The more we attempt to be in control, the less we journey. We get hung up. And that happens to humans. Happens to us all. God responds by silencing the external experiences. By the pleasant layers and the siren song, I conjure you to cease your anger and not touch the wall, that the bride may sleep in deeper peace. Again, it is happening to us. We're not doing it. As the soul rests, she experiences a deeper reconciliation. Reconciliation is bringing together opposites. Sin is separate. Holiness is union. Love and the absence of caring. Beneath the apple tree, there I took you for my own. There I offered you my hand and restored you where your mother was corrupted. The story of Adam and Eve is the story of disunion. The promise of God is union again. The ebb and flow continues. As it does, the soul begins to sense an inner authority that comes forth from a greater sense of authenticity. In the inner wine cellar, I drank of my beloved. And when I went abroad through all this valley, I no longer knew anything, and I lost the herd which I was following. The need to look for external authority weakens. As the soul begins to sense that its authenticity is not out there. It's within us. As we practice living the soul's newfound authority and authenticity, we discover that the soul's authority doesn't separate or cause us to lord it over others, as external authority tends to do. It rather draws us into union. And I gave myself to him, keeping nothing back. There I promised to be his bride. The transformation might surprise us, and often does. We stop doing for God and equally receive God doing for us. That is, we rest in stillness. We, by resting in stillness, become conduits of love, though not completely. John writes, "Now I occupy my soul in all my energy in his service. I no longer tend the herd, nor have I any other work, now that my every act is love." He continues, "If then I am no longer seen or found on the common, you will say that I am lost, that stricken by love, I lost myself and was found." We are found, but we are not complete or perfect. The struggle must continue, or we stagnate. "And one of my eyes wounded you." Only in this way can we know infinite mercy. "Do not despise me, for if before you found me dark, now truly you can look at me, since you have looked and left in me grace and beauty." Not about us. It's about what God does for us. Finally, in solitude, that is, in union with others. We tend to think of solitude as solitary. But solitude is in union with others. The soul has built her nest, and in solitude, in union with others, he guides her, he alone, who also bears in solitude, in union with others, the wound of love. The ego is transformed by the experience of union. Let us rejoice, beloved, and let us go forth to behold ourselves in your beauty, to the mountain and to the hill, to where the pure water flows, and further, deep into the thicket. Solitude, in union with, transfigures the ego so that the authentic self emits human activity divinely. That is, our lives on our better days become less resisting conduits of love. The human need to be noticed lessens. It doesn't completely go away. We might still blush if someone gives us a compliment. The human need to take offense once felt quickly dissipates. It doesn't mean that we don't take offense. Well, we discover that it doesn't last as long. The human need to do for others is transformed into our receiving and sharing. No one looked at her, John writes, nor did Amminadab appear. The siege was still, and the cavalry, at the sight of the waters, descended. Boo.